Hey guys, it's Albert. We got a big Super Bowl preview show for you today. We are going to address the big sports news of the week. Then we'll get into everything Super Bowl 45. We'll bring in a great guest to break down both teams and the quarterbacks. And of course, we wrap things up with all your questions in a special edition of the Six Pack. Let's go. All right, welcome in. The bye week is in the books. Super Bowl 54 week is here. I am in Miami. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. We got a special guest that's going to help us break down the quarterbacks, the genius of Kyle Shanahan, what Andy Reid does so well. We're going to break down all of that with our special guest. We're going to get to all your questions in the mailbag. But I'm going to start with my five takeaways for the week. And you know, the number one takeaway this week is going to relate back to Kobe Bryant. And the sports story of the week, the sports story of the year, the tragic passing of former Los Angeles Lakers star Kobe Bryant at the age of 41. Of course, his daughter and seven others were on the helicopter with him in Southern California. It's a sort of event that I think we'll all remember where we were. I was in my hotel room. I'd just gotten here to South Florida ahead of the Super Bowl on Sunday. And when you do a job like mine, one of the first things you do when something like this happens outside of what you cover, right? Like that, when something like this happens outside of just the what's immediately in front of your face, and what you cover, is you try to figure out whether or not it has an impact on the people you cover, on the sport you cover. And it was pretty obvious right away, to me at least, that this was absolutely one of those stories that was going to touch every corner of the sports world in this country. And the reason why is because Kobe was one of those athletes, that I think was on a different level from everyone else. And here's the best way I can explain this. So, when you get, and I hate to personalize everything, this isn't about me, but when you get into, covering the NFL or any other pro sports for a living, it starts to sort of lose its just the, and I don't even know how to put this, kind of like the luster is the wrong word, just everything sort of loses how special it was to you when you were a kid, right? Like, so being around the athletes, being around the games, being around the stadiums, it just naturally sort of becomes part of your daily life instead of something that was being, instead of what it was when you were a little kid. And so this was in my, I'm going into my seventh year covering the NFL in 2011. And I was at the Indianapolis Combine, and I'm at this steakhouse, and we'd had a few beers or whatever, and I'm going to the bathroom, and I go to the bathroom, and I go to wash my hands, and I look up in the mirror, and standing right next to me is John Elway, and it's a weird thing because the magnitude of the people around you sort of it isn't the same when you're covering them, right? But there are certain guys that when you were a kid that were sort of larger than life. And so, I when we walked out of the bathroom, I introduced myself. I talked to him on the phone previously. And, I just sort of for that second there, it was like, holy crap, that's John Elway. And the reason it was that way for me is because that's when I was a little kid, it was Elway, it was Montana, it was Marino. Those guys were on a different level from everybody else. And so when you just being around them, it just sort of took on a different meaning for me. And like even being 7 years into covering the NFL, I'd been around Peyton Manning. I'd been around Tom Brady. I'd been around so many guys that were, had outrageous fame as athletes. And, none of that would faze me anymore. But being in front of somebody who when I was a kid was that level of player, it was something different for me, And so, it's just in that moment, it sort of hit me. And it's like, it's one of those things that takes you back. And there are very few athletes that sort of achieve that level where they're kings among kings, right? And so, for me, when I was a kid, I said like the Marinos, the Montanas, the Elways, there were a few in football. And of course, the guy who was the one above all athletes when I was a kid was Michael Jordan. And if I'd ever been around, I think even now, like, and I've never been face to face with Michael Jordan, but even now, if I got in front of Michael Jordan, I think there would be a little bit like, that's Michael Jordan, you know, and it would be much different for me than being in front of, say, a LeBron James or being in front of a Kobe Bryant, because that's who it was when I was a kid, is that, like, you held this guy up on that pedestal. And, you know, so it's just when you get around him, it's like, it's just like a little different, you know, because it's like in a certain way, like when you do this for a living, it's just, you know, like, well, these guys were all sort of part of why I wound up doing this for a living. And so I, as a roundabout way of saying, I think that's who Kobe was for a lot of the guys who are in the NFL now. And it's very, very hard to achieve that level as an athlete where you're that iconic, where a generation identifies you as like a defining athlete of their childhood, you know? And so that's what Kobe was like, you know, and I'm about the same age as Kobe. I think I'm 2 years younger than Kobe. I was two high school classes behind Kobe, so I remember him coming out. So Kobe wasn't that for me, but for the guys who are in the NFL now, like, that's who Kobe was. And it was so interesting talking to a couple of NFL people about this over the last couple of days. You know, I talked to I talked to Tom Telesco, the GM of the Chargers, and, you know, he said like he just said, like, it just turned. And like, he had a way of turning an entire group of pro athletes. And Kobe had an office down the hall from the Chargers facility. And he'd come over and he'd talk to the team. And he said, like, when they brought Kobe out, it was like all these guys who were, you know, these confident, accomplished pro athletes, it turned them all into a bunch of fans. And, you know, I the Eagles, same thing. You know, Howie Roseman, I communicated with him on Sunday about it. And he said, All these guys who, you know, again, they were on. I mean, when they brought Kobe out, and they brought Kobe out in 2017 when they were staying in LA for a week, the Eagles did. They were on the verge of winning a championship. Like, that was a team that was going to win a title, and it was a veteran group. And, you know, they brought Kobe out, and Howie said, you know, like, the guys just melted. You know, like, the guys were, hey, can I get a picture? Hey, can I get an autograph? So it's just it's very rare that an athlete has that sort of impact. And look, he's got a complicated history. There's no question about it. And I'm not trying to gloss that over, because that's all there. And it's not hard to find the information if you want to go and seek it out. But I think it's very, very rare to find an athlete who achieves that level where, you know, almost a generation, like, looks at them as one of the defining people of their youth. And, you know, again, that was, for me, as somebody who grew up with football as my number one sport, it was Elway and Marino in Montana. But the overarching guy for us when we were kids was Michael Jordan. And I think in a similar way, Kobe sort of became that for the generation of kids that are now grown up to the point where they're, you know, NFL, like the NFL is full of those kids now. So I think that's sort of the impact it has on the NFL, and you can see it. All you got to do is go on social media. You can see how many guys are going on there and saying they were inspired by him. So, you know, that's sort of, you know, like what I, it was really interesting talking to people on Sunday night about that. And certainly tragic. You know, I think any of us who are parents can certainly, I mean, the thing that really gutted me was hearing that his 13-year-old daughter was on board. And he was doing something that so many of us do. He was taking his kids to play. He was taking his kid to go, you know, play. And, you know, so certainly sad, certainly tragic, and certainly touches every single corner of the sports world. Okay, now on to Super Bowl 54. I want to start with a takeaway on each of the quarterbacks, and then we'll move towards how they relate to what's going to happen. Now, those will be the next three takeaways. And my second takeaway for Super Bowl 54 after Kobe, takeaway number two for this week, is Patrick Mahomes has a chance this week to cement himself as the author of one of the great stretches of quarterbacking, I think, in NFL history. And I know that sounds crazy to say that, right? But if you look at the last 2 years, being able to win an MVP in his second year and the Super Bowl in his third year, and put up the numbers that he's put up and do it in the way that he's done it and do it for a team that is built, I mean, built in a way where he needs to be great to win, right? Like, they've got a defense that's to some degree built to play with a lead. They don't have a great running game. Like, he needs to be great. And he's been great. And he's been awesome in the playoffs. He overcame the injury this year. He was spectacular, like unstoppable in 2018. And I know it sounds crazy, but I think that if he's able to win a championship here and cap what he's done the last 2 years with a championship and get Andy Reid his first championship as a coach, I think, you know, we're going to be able to look at this as one of the great stretches of quarterbacking in NFL history. I know that sounds crazy, but I'll give you an example, and one that held up that probably would have sounded crazy in the moment too. Go to the beginning of Dan Marino's career and look at what he did in the 1984 season. And I'm sure there were people back then that were saying, well, you know, there's this reason and that reason why he's doing it. And, you know, let's not put the cart before the horse here. He's still a young player. Well, I still think most people would probably look back at what Dan Marino did in 84 and, you know, then followed up with in 85. Like, that's probably one of the great stretches of quarterbacking in NFL history. What John Elway did as a young player in 86, 87, 88, and 89, where he led the Broncos, teams that weren't that good, to the Super Bowl. I think we probably look at those years as one of the great stretches in quarterbacking history. And so I think Mahomes has a chance as a young player to join that group and put together a stretch of play that I think can match up with any of them. And I think a championship is the sort of thing that if you take what Marino did, you take what Elway did, you notice they didn't win championships in there. If he can put a championship on top of everything that he's done the last 2 years, I certainly think that there's a chance that we're going to be sitting here and saying in 10 years, in 15 years, what Patrick Mahomes was doing at the turn of the decade in 2019 and 2020 and was as impressive a job of quarterbacking, as one of the most impressive jobs of quarterbacking as we've ever seen in the NFL. Okay, takeaway number three. Stop criticizing Jimmy Garoppolo. I know he's only thrown for 200 yards over the last 2 weeks. You know, I know that they haven't needed him to be great. What I would tell you is that San Francisco team was damn close to being undefeated. How close? Well, I can take you guys through it. They had three losses in 2019, right? Three losses. The first loss came against the Seattle Seahawks in overtime on a Monday night, okay? The second loss came on a long Justin Tucker field goal in the rain in Baltimore. And the third loss came on a review, Julio Jones scoring a touchdown at the very end of a game in Week 15. Those are their three losses. They lost those three games by a grand total of 13 points. And what that signifies is Jimmy Garoppolo never really laid an egg this year. Jimmy Garoppolo was consistent through the year, and that's what you want from your quarterback. And when Jimmy Garoppolo needed to be good, needed to be really good, the Niners won. Okay? He threw for over 300 yards three times. The Niners were 3-0 in those games. He threw for 300 yards against the Cardinals. They won 28-25. He threw for 424 yards against the Cardinals. They won 36-26. And he threw for 349 yards against the Saints. It was spectacular that day and won in New Orleans. I think what we're seeing from Jimmy Garoppolo here is a little bit more. We've seen this before where quarterbacks are developed in a way. Some quarterbacks are developed in impossible situations where they need to be awesome on a week-to-week basis. Other quarterbacks are brought along slowly where they can be the bus driver early on, and then eventually they get to the point where they're able to carry a team. And two great examples of that, the latter, are Tom Brady and Russell Wilson. Tom Brady didn't need to be great in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004 because he had great teams around him. And so when they needed him to be awesome, he was awesome. When they needed him to be a bus driver, he was a bus driver. And he was able to develop in that environment, and it really worked for them. And so, you know, for the first 4 years of his career as a starter, 01 to 04, the Patriots really supported him in a lot of different ways. And they didn't need him. They didn't put the burden on him to win games on a week-to-week basis. But when they had to pull that lever, they could pull that lever. Same thing with the Seahawks and Russell Wilson. First 4 years of his career as a starter, 2012 to 2015, Like, they didn't need him to be great. There were weeks where he wasn't. There were weeks where he wasn't throwing the ball much. There were weeks where Marshawn Lynch carried the team. There were weeks where the defense was winning games. They brought those guys along that way, and eventually they were able to ask more of them, but they didn't initially. And it wound up being a really smart way to develop their quarterbacks. And I think Russell Wilson and Tom Brady were better for having come along that way because they learned how to play winning football that way. And so I just look at the Jimmy Garoppolo evolution, and I say to myself, this is a good thing that they're not asking the world of him. This is like the fact that they're able to win two playoff games with Jimmy Garoppolo throwing a total of 27 passes in those two games. Not only is really, really impressive, it's good for Garoppolo. And so, like, I have no problem with the way that this is all unfolded for the Niners. And I certainly think if they've got to pull that lever on Sunday, they'll be able to pull it, which brings me to takeaway number four, why I think the 49ers are going to win. One team needs his quarterback to throw for 300 yards on Sunday. The other team doesn't. And generally, the team that doesn't need its quarterback to throw for 300 yards in a setting like this wins. And I'm going to give you a great example of this from a decade ago. There's a reason why Tom Brady and the Patriots had their way with Peyton Manning and the Colts early in his career. And it's because they got into these games in the playoffs where weather might be a factor, where pressure might be a factor, where there are a million different things going on, and where you're so focused on one opponent and just getting by that week. And you know what happens in those sorts of situations? What happens in those sorts of situations is you run into teams that are good enough to take what you do away, what you do well away. And so if you can't win in multiple ways, that becomes a little bit of a problem. Now, the Chiefs are better in that area than they have been, okay? The defense is much better than it has been. The running game isn't quite what it was when they had Kareem Hunt. But the Chiefs are becoming more well-rounded. They're way more well-rounded than they were at this time last year. And that's a credit to the job Brett Veach has done. That's a credit to the job Steve Spagnuolo has done. That's a credit to the additions of guys like Frank Clark and Tyrann Mathieu and what they brought to the table. But if let's just say you take away the primary strength of each team on Sunday, right? So let's say you force the Chiefs to beat you with the run game, right? And you do some things where you say, we're going to tee off on Patrick Mahomes. We don't care about the run game. Feel free to run the ball all you want. We're going to come after you. We're going to drop guys into coverage. And if you want to run the ball for 200 yards on us, run the ball for 200 yards on us. But we're not going to let you beat us with just Patrick Mahomes. Say the Chiefs are able to minimize what the Niners do in the run game and say, okay, you're going to have to beat us with Jimmy Garoppolo and Debo Samuel and George Kittle. What do you have more confidence? Like, what are you more confident that's going to happen? I think the Niners are more comfortable playing a game left-handed right now than the Chiefs are. And that's why when I say the Niners don't need their quarterback to throw for 300 yards and the Chiefs do, why I think that's a determining factor. It's right there for you. If one of the teams takes away what the other team does well, who's got a better chance to win? And I think it's the Niners. Finally, number four, the Browns have officially hired Andrew Berry as their new general manager and executive vice president of football operations. First of all, this is as far as getting the organization aligned, I can get on board with that part of this. Andrew Berry and Kevin Stefanski met for the first time last year during the interview process. They were able to strike up a relationship. They stayed in touch, even though neither guy was with the Browns last year. Of course, Stefanski was in Minnesota and Andrew Berry was in Philadelphia. They stayed in touch via text. They saw each other when their two teams played each other. Obviously both have a strong advocate in the building or had a strong advocate in the building coming into this process, and Paul DePodesta, the chief strategy officer. I can agree with all of that. I think so much of this is going to come down to support staff now. You've hired a young head coach who's only got 1 year of coordinating experience. You've hired a young GM at 32 years old who is not a pure scout, who for the Eagles was doing sort of a lot of different things, who's sort of been a jack of all trades for Philly. And what that says to me, Kevin Stefanski is going to need a strong coaching staff around him. And that includes, I think some strong offensive coaches. We already believe we know who his defensive coordinator is going to be in Joe Woods. But he's going to need strong coaches around him. And on the scouting side, whether it's Elliot Wolf and Alonzo Highsmith staying on board, or Andrew Berry maybe bringing in somebody like ex-Colts GM Ryan Grigson, he's going to need strong evaluators there. He's going to need a couple strong scouts there. And so do I think this can work? Maybe. Those are both smart guys, Andrew Berry and Kevin Stefanski. I think what this might boil down to, though, is their ability to hire the people that you probably aren't going to hear as much about, the assistant coaches, the scouts, to fill in sort of for some of the inexperience. And this is going to take those guys, again, smart guys, Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, being honest with themselves about where their deficiencies are and where their holes are. All right, with that, we're going to get to our special guest right after this. All right, well, for this week's edition, I wanted to bring in somebody to give you real insight into what's actually going to happen on Sunday. And so I was able to dig up somebody who, and I guess, is that disrespectful? So I dug you up?
You know, sometimes I'm underneath some leaves and maybe an inch of dirt, but you're not dug up too much. You can probably dig me up with your hands, not necessarily with a shovel. So,
all right.
Or a spade, I guess you would say. So, we found each other at Radio Row.
And we're in an Uber.
We're in an Uber right now
in Miami Beach.
We're heading back to the hotel. We're going to watch some film.
That's right. We're going to watch some film with my colleague, Greg Bishop. But part of the reason we wanted to have this guest on is because he can give us real insight into what we're going to see on Sunday on several different levels. He's Sage Rosenfels, was a quarterback in the league for 12 years, played for five different teams, works at the Quarterback Collective now, sees a lot of these kids coming up from the time they're 16, 17 years old, and is going to kind of give us an overview of sort of what's created certain reasons for these teams being here. And I think the first one I want to start with you, Sage, and this is actually kind of like the jumping off point for our whole conversation about doing this in the first place, is what Kyle Shanahan's done.
Yeah.
And not just what he's done this year, but what he's done now in several different places. And, you know, you always hear that this is the most difficult offense for a defense to prepare for. And you always see like Vrabel, like there've been certain different coaches who work on the defensive side of the ball who will hire guys because they had a hard time with that offense. And so I just want to start with like a broad question here on Kyle. And you were with Kyle for 3 years in Houston, I believe, two of those 3 years he was the coordinator.
Yeah.
So you know him pretty well. Like what makes that offense so difficult for a defense to play against?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's not a simple question or simple answer. But you know, one thing about the offense is it is very complex. But for the quarterback, it's actually fairly simple in a lot of ways, if that makes any sense. And you know, Jason Garrett one time had a great quote. He said to me, you know, the smartest people in the world take really complex situations and they make them simple. They mm-hmm. keep them simple. You know, some people that aren't as bright, maybe they'll take a simple situation and make it overly complex. We've all seen that in our personal lives sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, with friends and things like that. Like, this is not that complicated. Why are you making this thing so complex? Well, Kyle breaks everything down, starting off with that running game, what they do, but it's all about gaps and about what defensive rules are. And a lot of people don't realize in the sport of football, a lot of coaches start off coaching offense or defense when they're, you know, they played offense or they coach offense, right? So you get into coaching, you're a quality control, you're a grad assistant, college, wherever it might be, but you generally stay on that side of the ball. Well, what Kyle did is when he was an offensive quality control in Tampa, he would regularly sit in Monty Kiffin's meetings on the defensive side of the ball. On that staff was Mike Tomlin. On that staff was Gus Bradley, obviously Kiffin, and the other coaches there. So he was learning all the rules of how defenses work. I mean, precise rules on gaps and gap integrity and what the rules are for the cornerback and what type of technique he's playing in versus this coverage and blah, blah, blah. So he learned all the rules of the defense from a really finite, precise level. And then when he became an offensive coach, he started using those rules against the defenses that he was playing against. I think a lot of offensive coaches don't have that inside sort of knowledge of spending a lot of time in the defensive rooms, whether it's install or their game plan stuff or whatever. Kyle did that, and I think that gave him this sort of leg up of going, okay, well, in this style where it's a 3-4 defense or a 4-3 defense, this is what that guy's taught to do. Let's try to manipulate in some way to make his job really hard. And so he's created this system where, again, if you look at defense, everything is about gaps. Everyone has to be in some sort of gap for the running game. Well, then he manipulates those by, you know, have it, let's say a receiver is going to block a safety. Well, if the receiver blocks a safety, now the corner has to fill in for that gap. They call that a crack replace. Well, if the corner's filling fast, now we'll do a play action, go over that guy's head, and throw a high corner route or something like that. If he's slow, we'll take 6 and 7 yard runs all day. So he'll break the whole thing down to a lot of times to one player on the defensive side that they're going to pick on any particular play. And on top of it, When you do all the outside zone stuff that they do, now they do a lot of counters and traps now more than they ever used to, but that the basics of it is the outside zone stuff. And when you have a really fast offensive line, and this is, by the way, the lightest offensive line in the NFL. They weigh about 295. So these guys can run, but they're not great in straight drop back pass protection. But when these guys are running on that outside zone towards the line of scrimmage, again, the defensive players, they have to be gap sound. They have to run too. So you have nose tackles and DNs and the linebackers running down the line, making sure they stay in their gaps. And then all of a sudden, Jimmy Garoppolo pulls the football. Now he's got all this time in play action and the bootleg stuff to take real shots down the field. You know, I always say when you drop back pass in the NFL, the linebackers, the safeties, the corners, they're dropping too. Yep. They don't want you to throw the ball deep. They want to, it's like an umbrella, whether it's cover two or cover three, they want to keep the ball in front of you. In front of them. But when you do the play action stuff, those linebackers have to fill, sometimes the safeties have to fill, sometimes it's a corner. Now you actually have more time, and you've distorted the defense to where those linebackers and safeties aren't in their design spots and just in the coverage aspect, you know, of the defense. So there's these really big cavities and holes, you know, beyond the linebackers, in front of the safeties, or even when the safety steps up to go deep with it. So, you know, that running game truly marries with the passing game, and they look so much like each other. And even going back to, you know, 2007, 2008, when I was playing for Kyle in Houston, I remember officials walking up to me, the back official, the one that stands behind the free safety, saying, I can't tell if it's run or pass. You guys' stuff looks the exact same. And people talk about, you know, your running game should look like your passing game. And I think sometimes it's real, and sometimes it's like, yeah, you want to have a little play action, whatever. Kyle's stuff looks exactly like that. And it's sort of, if you're going to do this, we'll just do this. If you're going to do that, we'll just do this. And he doesn't try to force feed, like, oh, we're going to run this play versus all fronts no matter what. Like, no, he tries to find the right type of defense, the right type of thing to pick on somebody. And it just, it makes it really, really hard for a defensive coordinator, a defense, to be sound all the time. And, you know, in every defense, there's a weakness, and Kyle seems to do a great job of exploiting those weaknesses.
So I said to you last night that, that sounds to me like the offense I played in high school, which is the wing T. And, like, the principle of it maybe isn't that different. It's just make four things look like one and make them defend four things when you're only doing one. And then, you know, there's answers for everything.
And then also, you know, do those four things, but do it out of, a lot of times, different formations. But at the end of the day, and that's the thing which I say, he has this complex system that makes the life of the quarterback much easier. For Jimmy Garoppolo, he's not having to go through super complex reads or all these plays.
So does he know who he's throwing to before the snap?
A lot of times, yeah. I mean, he gives you a lot of indicators, you know, man zone indicators, or, you know, he teaches you the things of, like, you know, you walk up to the line of scrimmage and the defensive end is in a tighter technique, that's probably going to be a certain coverage. If he's in a Y technique, that's a different coverage. A lot of coaches don't get into that type of detail, but the way Kyle game plans, so when Jimmy gets the ball in his hands, a lot of time he knows where he's going to go with the football. And to have that sort of black and white thinking for a quarterback really allows you to just go out and play and not have to overthink about everything. And he doesn't put quarterbacks too much in charge of, like, the protections and all those things. He puts that on the line so a quarterback can go through his reads, so he can go, you know, cover three are over here, cover two are over here. And again, those play action bootlegs where he has tons of time, he makes the job for the quarterback much easier than a lot of other offenses I was in the NFL.
So I've heard, too, that, like, And I know, I mean, he said this before, like how specific they are and what they look for in every position too. And I remember Brian Hoyer taking me through it, right? Like, and he's like, he needs a dominant X. That was in Atlanta. That was some. We'll go through the Atlanta one. Like that
Andre
was
Johnson. Julio yeah. Jones was Andre Johnson.
right. And then like he needs a burner. Well, that was Taylor Gabriel. He needs a possession guy. That was Sanu. He needs a center who can take the protection calls from the quarterback. That was Alex Mack. Like, could you see?
But tight ends that can do both.
Yeah.
Tight ends can do it, the first and the second guy. You know, he doesn't want just a blocking guy and guy that's just a catch. You know, he grew up with Shannon Sharp, you know, watching his with playing for his dad, who was really just a pass catching guy. And that's why Kittle's so special. But when I was in Houston, we had Owen Daniels and Joel Dreesen, who are quality blockers and pretty good pass catchers as well. So you got to have two guys at that position too, and obviously a fullback who is not just your classic, you know, downhill battering ram fullback, a guy who's really athletic and almost can play that second tight end position, and they have that, you know, as well. So, yeah, the weapons are also a major part of this offense. He really wants to have at least one, but really going into the season, I think he'd prefer to have two or even three guys at the receiver position that can really fly.
Right.
I mean, like the 4.3, the Olympic sprinter type guys. Of course, you want to have good hands and all those things, but...
Which is, sort of the perception I got was, like, somebody explained this to me with, like, the you know, the zone running. It's like, we don't need a guy that can make 15 guys miss. If a guy can run 4.4, like, we're going to give them the crease, and he can burst through it. And
the
like,
running back just ran for 200 yards, right, and that's he's been cut by, like, six teams or something.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, I think it is part of the speed thing then. Like, I'm going to create space for him. I just need him to run.
That's exactly right. And again, like those play-action bootleg things allow those receivers to really get far down the field. Right. We're not talking like just straight throwing go routes here, right? We're talking about double posts and things. But what that does is attract so much attention by the corners and safeties because they know that these guys can roll. Believe me, if you're a cornerback or a safety in the NFL, you're looking at the other team and be like, oh, man, they got Taylor Gabriel or they got this guy or that guy that can really fly. I'm going to play 4 or 5 yards deeper. Well, then that opens it up, right, for the Andre Johnsons of the world or the Deebo Samuels of the world who aren't super, super fast, but they get all the quality stuff underneath because they have those guys that can fly. Plus, also on the play action stuff, to have guys that can really stretch a defense when you have more time in the pocket, that's a big advantage too.
So I've heard a lot of people say Kyle is like, and you can import any of his assists, but Kyle's a little different. Why is he different than other coaches? Because there are other guys who've done a really good job coaching it. Obviously, Sean in L.A., LaFleur in Green Bay. What makes Kyle a little different than the rest of them?
Well, I think Kyle is, one, I think he's the mastermind of the whole thing. I really do believe. He learned really good basic principles from John Gruden in Tampa, from Gary Kubiak, who was our head coach, and it was really sort of Gary's offense originally before Kyle sort of took it over. He learned some great principles from those guys, but then Kyle's a very creative guy. He has a mind that sort of is thinking all the time and goes a million miles an hour. So he comes up with things that maybe the traditional coaches don't always see or don't always come up with. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with him understanding defenses really well and understanding the exact rules of the defense to then come up with just sort of new ideas and new things. But again, at the end of the day, still keeping, you know, things fairly basic for the quarterback sometimes. So those coaches have all had a ton of success. It really is crazy that, you know, in the NFC in the last 2 years, of the four head coaches, three of them are part of the same little, you know, inner circle. I mean, that is pretty phenomenal. And
when you look at the championship games, they all are like three of the four. It was the Titans, right? Who that offense was put in by LaFleur, and then Arthur Smith takes it over, and then LaFleur against Kyle in the championship game.
Unbelievable, right? I mean, yeah. And then obviously McVay, you know, a success last year. But you know, they all the funny thing is, all three of those coaches are sort of the three-headed monster right now. It's the cup of coffee with Sean McVay, Kyle Shanahan thing. But they have similar offenses. I would say Kyle's is the most creative and dynamic. But, you know, Sean is probably the best communicator. Like, he's like, Sean walks in the room and, you know, we all see the videos. You feel it. You know, he's got this presence about him. Kyle's not necessarily like that. And then LaFleur is the third on that level of, like, he's pretty calm and quiet and more subdued and not like a big rah-rah. Like, Matt LaFleur probably wouldn't be a great college football coach. He's not a salesman, right? Yeah. I mean, he's like, but they're all very real. And I think that's what Kyle, when he was the receivers coach in Houston, my first year of 2006, that I learned from him is how he related to those wide receivers, to guys like Andre Johnson. Like, who is this 25, 26-year-old kid who's going to tell Andre Johnson what to do? He's already been to a couple of Pro Bowls. But being that Kyle played wide receiver, but he also, he sort of comes from that, and not the millennial crowd, but the younger sort of, can really relate. I mean, he listens to the same music. You know, he's
that's true,
which is very true. Lil Wayne is this guy. I mean, I think maybe it's not 10 years later, but it was 10 years ago. So he really relates to people, and you can, when he is installing plays, when he is watching film, you can feel him in a sense of, you can feel what he's trying to get across to you. You know, you can sort of, the way he describes things, that's where Kyle's communication is so good, is how he describes what he wants and why and what's the reason defensively. I think the receivers heard that. And then he got in the quarterback's room, and we could really understand that. They all three of those coaches are good communicators in their own different way. But I do think Kyle's offense is probably the most creative and dynamic, which isn't always a great thing. Sometimes it's like it can be too much. Like, you know, it's, I think that's where, like, him and Gary Kubiak are similar, but, you know, Kubiak is much more, and I would say old school, but he doesn't try to do too many things, because if you do everything, then you're not good at anything, right? But Kyle has the ability to do a lot of things, but yet still be really, really good again, because he keeps those principles very much the same for a lot of the players, especially the quarterback.
So is it oversimplifying it to say, I've had a couple of guys say this to me, the idea of the whole thing is make it look complicated for the defense when it's really simple for the offense?
1,000%. That's absolutely what you always want to do. Yeah. And again, if you have these sort of basic rules and basic principles, then you dress it up with formations and things. Now, some coaches I always felt like would dress it up, but it wouldn't really give you an advantage. Yeah. Kyle will dress it up in a way that gives you an advantage, right, where, you know, he'll start Kittle on outside.
Like, it's almost like you're taking, like a coach is taking, it's like, I'm going to take the put the complicated part on me.
That's
right?
Coaching.
Like, put the complicated part on me. Like, I'm going to take, like, the whole every complication with this is all on me, and you just do what I'm telling you to do.
Exactly. Yeah, sir, do your job. But he does communicate it really well, so the players start to understand what his thinking is, and they go, oh, I see that. Now I get it. Yeah. And if you look at Kyle's offense in that NFC Championship game, that's a different offense that you're going to get in the first day of OTAs in the summertime, right? I mean, it's like a menu. You walk in, and first there's only 6 items on it. And then next thing you know, by the end of the season, there's 1,000 items on it. Like, he builds and he builds and he builds and he builds. And then as things work, you know, teams are going to stop them, so now we'll do this. And
also, but they're all related to each other.
But they're all related at the end of the day.
It's just like a lot of the same stuff just looks different, which is the whole dressing it up thing.
And what we're going to watch here, and we watch a little film here this afternoon, you know, like when they play the Packers last week, the Packers do some different things defensively to take advantage of their defensive ends and Za'Darius Smith and things like that. But then what Kyle does is sort of, okay, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Yeah. So if you're going to play your defensive ends wide, we're going to run inside, or we're going to trade our tight end to get some sort of advantage. So he just has a really great way of giving the offense either a small or even big advantage, rather than just trying to just line up and just trying to sort of, you know, outman you with power and big offensive linemen and things like that. It's a lot more strategy and a ton of detail.
I want to go to the other side now, because there are two teams in this. And, like, having played the position, when you watch Pat, what separates him? Like, what makes him different than, and I know I sort of asked the same question with Kyle, what makes Kyle different, but I feel like they probably are the two primary difference makers in this matchup, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like so what makes Pat?
They're like the most talented people in this whole thing, You know, one's a coach and one's a player.
Right.
I, more and more lately, I've been describing quarterbacks as point guards. Mm-hmm. All right. So, I do a 3-day-a-week radio show in Minneapolis, and they got Kirk Cousins up there, right? So, to put Kirk Cousins and Pat Mahomes in the same you know, Boat is like, they're very different. Both very successful this year. You know, Kirk's stats this year were like top five in the NFL. But I look at Kirk Cousins as John Paxson, and I look at Pat Mahomes as like Steph Curry, and that's the difference.
And so, Sage, you were making the point about John Paxson, and kind of like,
yeah. So Kirk Cousins is a guy who can like be a part of the offense, but he's not creating for other people, right? But when the shot's there, John Paxson used to hit the big shot, right? Yeah. Well, Kirk hits the shot when it's open, but he doesn't create things when it's not open.
Right.
But that's what Michael Jordan did. That's what Steph Curry does. They create for other people. That's what Pat Mahomes does, is he creates things when the original play call is simply just not there. I think what Andy Reid has always done a great job, did it with Favre and did it with Holmes, did it with McNabb, is take guys who are great athletes with really good arms, who maybe in college were more playmakers, but then give them really good structure of like really good concepts in the NFL, these sort of NFL structure concepts, and be able to sort of rein in some of that creativity and say, listen, you got to execute first and then try to make magic happen if that first execution doesn't break down. Because you can't just spend the entire game running around and trying to make magic. You just can't.
Yeah.
Like the Joey Bosa's of the world will literally kill you and you won't last very long in the league. So you have to have that foundation. I think Andy Reid does a great job. He did it with Favre and did it with McNabb, I think, in Philadelphia, was to have those sort of basic, a lot of times West Coast plays that, you know, footwork and timing and those things, which Pat learned from Alex Smith. I mean, what a perfect guy to come in. That's not a create guy. That's like go through your reads, good footwork, get the ball out fast, read coverages, those types of things. So Pat does that really, really well. But then he had this whole other element to it, to where it's that like the Jordan, the Steph Curry.
He breaks the rule. Like the rules, we were talking about breaking the rule. Like, he breaks the rules. Like, so for a defense, he make, I mean, I remember talking to him where he said, like, you learn, like, learn from being a shortstop, right? Like, because when you're playing shortstop, you have to throw off balance all the time.
Yeah.
Like, he's able to do things other people can't do. So, like, the rules of defending a quarterback are kind of go out the window with him.
Well, what I love about the way he plays is, you know, all these kids now go to all these football camps and, you know, college coaches, and they try to get them to throw perfectly, and here's your mechanics, and here's our mechanics guy, which is important. Don't get me wrong, right? It's like golf, okay? There's your swing coach who helps you on the range. But that doesn't mean you're, just because you can hit it good on the range doesn't mean you can play golf and know how to play the course, okay? A good coach helps you play the course. And what Mahomes does is he's like Tiger. He went on the range. He goes, I want to slice this one. I want to hook this one. I want to hit this one low because it's going to be a windy day, blah, blah, whatever. He learned how to hit all the weird shots rather than just like the guy who was taught how to hit it straight every single shot, right? But that allows him now to be way more creative when those things need to occur, because and that's where Kirk Cousins struggles. He struggles when you have
off
to be
schedule.
Off schedule. They get almost none of that in Minnesota.
And Mahomes is almost better. It's almost like you want to keep him on schedule.
Yeah. You almost like you want him to throw from the pocket. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, because when he does get out, his mix of arm strength and accuracy and athleticism, but also from what I've heard, you know, Matt Moore's a good friend of mine, one of his backups. The way he sees the field, Matt Moore, like, I've never seen anything like it. Now, Matt's been around the league for, I don't know, 12, 13, something, a long time. And for him to say that he's never seen somebody see the field like a young quarterback, the way he does it with all the natural ability, I really do think if Pat Mahomes doesn't get hurt, he'll go down as one of the great quarterbacks of all time. But, you know, just like what we're seeing, you know, like the Eli conversation is like, well, he's not a Hall of Famer, but like, I'm like, you know, you play 16 years in the NFL and you don't get hurt. Like, that is crazy.
Right.
You know, that's like London Fletcher should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion, because he just got a guy who played so many snaps in a row. But so that's going to be the question for Pat Mahomes is, can he do this type of
stuff?
Is it
sustainable?
Is it sustainable for a long, long time? Right. It's not, because you're just naturally going to get less athletic.
And he got hurt.
In your mid-30s. Then you get hurt. So the question is,
can Favre at the end too, right? Like, Favre was like a good part of him.
Favre is like the uncle that you have that has like like giant wrists and forearms, and his fingers are like, you know, giant sausages. He's just like one of these old, the men from the old days. Yeah. You know, like they don't make him like that, you know, very much anymore.
So he could take it.
Country strong, I like to call that, right? So he could sort of take all those hits, and I don't know how his bones didn't break over those years. Mahomes is a big, strong guy, but he's not like that. So I just, you don't see, and Russell Wilson's a guy who's playing for a longer time, who does run around and do a lot of those things, but he's also smaller, and he's super strong, and he can protect himself.
Sure.
Mahomes, you know, bigger. It means there's more areas to hit, right? Mm-hmm. More chances to get hurt. So he's going to have to rely on less of this playmaking stuff as his career progresses. But right now, it's like, so valuable.
And Roethlisberger was like somebody who did that, right?
Rodgers.
Like sort of dial it back a little bit.
I think one of the reasons the Packers had a good year this year is because Rodgers was asked to do less of that stuff. Like, hey, it's okay just to hand the ball off. So, I know the defense sort of set to stop this run, but we're going to hand the ball off because we don't want to throw the ball 50 times a game.
So he's able to dial it back, and it's just like, use it when you need it, but don't use it.
Exactly. It's exactly right. I've always said, Rodgers' stats this year were similar to what his were in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never throws a lot of interceptions. I think he threw four this year, something like that. But he had a running game. He used his defense. Like, there's not... You don't just win football games by putting up a lot of yards. There's all these aspects to it of when you run the ball, you keep the ball away from the defense. The easiest thing for a quarterback to do is to hand the ball off.
Yeah.
If you never have to throw a pass to win, you should never throw a pass.
And the Niners showed us that.
Right? So I think that's where, like you said, is where Aaron was better this year, was not having to be clutch on first and second down. Be clutch on third down. Clutch in the red zone. Be clutch at the end of the halves.
Okay. So we're going to go watch some film, but I do need to get a pick from you. Do you have, like right now, and we're 5 days out, and I know this is subject to change, but who's going to win on Sunday?
Oh, the whole, choose something that when I'm wrong, like no one will come back and say anything to me about.
Right.
Well, I can't say, I'm rooting for the 49ers because of my connections with all those guys on that staff, the 49ers. But I just don't know if they can keep up with Mahomes. I think they're going to score 30 points, and I don't know if San Francisco can score, you know, 30 points, you know, with their style. But I think it's going to come down to, if San Francisco can run the football, they got a good chance to win this game. If they can't run the football, that's going to be a lot of third and long situations, and that's where this offensive line struggles, being that, again, they're the lightest in the NFL. They struggle with just straight drop back pass protection sometime. So to me, that is the number of all the things you look at when you go into a game, can or cannot the 49ers run the football.
All right, he's Sage Rosenfels, 12-year NFL veteran, 5 different teams. They can find you on Twitter at Sage
Rosenfels 18. And work with the Quarterback Collective and
and
training some of these high school and college kids. That's been a really, really fun thing, trying to teach these guys NFL offenses and NFL protections and the complexity of the game. And I do some stuff for the Score North in Minneapolis, or I cover the Vikings 3 days a week.
Okay, appreciate it, Sage. We're going to go watch some tape. You can check out us watching tape with Sage on SI.com later in the week.
All right, thanks to Sage for that. Always awesome talking to him. He does a fantastic job with all of his analysis, and certainly appreciate him coming in and educating everybody on Kyle Shanahan, on Pat Mahomes, on Jimmy Garoppolo, and all of it. So we're going to jump into another special edition of the Six Pack. Of course, I do this when I'm on the road. The reason why, because we can't have Shelby here and the voicemails here and all of that different stuff. So we simplify a little bit, go back to what we have done in the past, and that's just putting the call out for questions on Twitter. I pick 6. If I pick yours, you get a like on Twitter. That means I press the little heart button, and you get an answer right here on the podcast. So question number 1, this is from Sheldrick Carter. That's at Sheldrick Carter 2. How soon after the Super Bowl do you expect teams to start cutting players? Sheldrick, traditionally, that's starting earlier and earlier. So I would not be surprised if next week we start to hear about this player being informed he's being released, that player being informed he's released. And here's the reason why. Those teams that do that are trying to do their players a solid, because those guys are able to get out there on the free agent market a little bit faster and ahead of the other guys. And so how does that manifest itself? Well, if you're a team that says has a need for throw a position out there. Say your team has a need for a corner, and say Xavier Rhodes becomes available, right? Well, the ability to take care of that early and not have to get into a bidding war for somebody in traditional free agency in the middle of March, you may look at it and say, we like Xavier Rhodes as a reclamation project, So why don't we just give him a nice chunk of change right now, because we don't want to get into the market where the bidding is going to get out of control in a month. And Xavier Rhodes can benefit from that because he's not dealing with the competition of younger players on the open market, and he can get his situation settled much earlier than anyone else. And so oftentimes players prefer to be cut earlier, and that's why we've seen it happen earlier and earlier. And I certainly think that we'll see some significant names cut, maybe not right after the Super Bowl, but you know, you'll certainly start to hear about that sort of thing as we get closer to the combine, which is the end of February. Question number two from Seth Ranson. That's at Seth Ranson 89. What will New England do at quarterback if Brady does leave? Seth, I personally think that the Patriots should be pulling every lever. And so that means letting Jared Stidham compete for the job, bringing in a veteran, and drafting someone. And the example that I've used here that I think is the perfect one to sort of explain why you do this is Green Bay in 2008. Brett Favre announced his retirement early in the offseason. They had Aaron Rodgers coming back. They drafted Aaron Rodgers 3 years earlier with the 24th overall pick. They felt good about Aaron Rodgers' development, but did they stand pat? No, they did not. They drafted Brian Brohm out of Louisville with a second-round pick and Matt Flynn out of LSU with a seventh-round pick. And people looked at that and said to themselves, well, is this a vote of no confidence for Aaron Rodgers? And it really wasn't. It was more, let's cover ourselves at the position. Because until you've actually seen a guy starting a full season of games, you don't really know what you have. And so if you like a player in the draft or you like a player in free agency, it's worthwhile to go get a player so you have another dart to throw at the dartboard. Another good example of a team that I kept throwing darts at the dartboard was the Seattle Seahawks. And when Pete Carroll and John Schneider got there, they didn't go all in on a quarterback right away. They brought back Matt Hasselbeck for a year. They brought in Tavares Jackson from Minnesota. They traded for Charlie Whitehurst. They signed Matt Flynn. And eventually, with a third-round pick, they landed on Russell Wilson. But they kept throwing darts at that dartboard. And so I think if Brady does leave, then you start to throw darts. Maybe it's signing a reclamation project like Marcus Mariota. Maybe it's bringing in a bridge type of veteran like Andy Dalton. Maybe it's drafting a guy like Jake Fromm in the second round. I know they feel good about where Jared Stidham is. I don't know that he's ready to be a starting quarterback. I think regardless of any of that, you just continue to take shots. And so if I'm the Patriots, I lose Brady. I plan on carrying three quarterbacks in 2020. And, you know, with the likelihood that one is a veteran addition and then another is a rookie coming via the draft. Question number three, this is from Michael, and that's at Michael 82002602. Who's the best coach we've never heard of? That's a great question, Michael, because we're here for Super Bowl week. I'll give you one coach on each staff that I believe has had a big impact on what's going on in their building that you may not have heard of. Each guy has a real future and maybe is a head coach in the NFL. On the Niners side, it's Mike McDaniel, who is their run game coordinator and is the one guy who Kyle Shanahan has brought with him from every stop to the next stop. He brought him from Houston to Washington, from Washington to Cleveland, from Cleveland to Atlanta, and finally from Atlanta to San Francisco. He's widely known as sort of the other side of Kyle Shanahan's brain. He is, I think, as good a young tactician as there is in the NFL. And I think it'd be really interesting to see him call an offense somewhere. Hopefully he gets that chance. Obviously it's not going to happen in San Francisco because Kyle's the play caller, but he's somebody who, you know, is very, very well thought of in that building in San Francisco and has been at the heart of the revival of the Niners. And then on the other side, I would give you Chiefs quarterbacks coach Mike Kafka, who has been the subject of teams trying to has been the subject of requests from teams trying to get him as their offensive coordinator. I do believe that he will be Andy Reid's next offensive coordinator whenever Eric Bieniemy winds up getting his shot as a head coach. I don't think it would take Andy Reid more than a couple minutes to walk down the hall and promote Mike Kafka. But I know that they look at him in that building as sort of the next in the line. They went from Peterson to Nagy to Bieniemy, sort of the next in line to become an offensive coordinator and certainly a guy who they view as a future head coach. And of course, people who went to Northwestern, who I worked with a couple of them, and people who are fans of the Eagles remember Mike Kafka from his playing days. Question number four, this is from Christian, and I'm not going to butcher your last name. Kolichevev, at Boston Broker 33, odds of a 17-game season in a new CBA. I hope it's 0%. I think you're out of luck. It's not 0%. The owners did promise the players that it will not happen in 2021. However, the likelihood is, or it won't happen until at least 2021. However, the likelihood is it's going to be a part of any deal that they do. I have a hard time seeing a scenario now where it doesn't happen. At first, I thought it was one of these chips that the league was generating to sort of put out there and then take off the table in exchange for something else. I don't believe that's the case now. I think this is very much related to the broadcast deal and being able to squeeze some more money out of Fox, out of ESPN, out of NBC and CBS. You know, another swing at getting Roger Goodell closer to that total revenue goal of $25 billion. So I think it's close to 100% that they get it in the new CBA. The players don't want it, but I do think that because the current players have been vocal about not wanting it, you could see the institution of it backed up maybe even to 2022, but I do think it's coming. Question number five, this is from Tom Marshall. It's at Red Zanuck. As Sean Payton did demanding in Super Bowl 44, does the key to the 49ers' success lay in keeping Mahomes off the field? Yes, it does. I'm 100% with you on that. And so earlier in the week I was sort of asking around to different guys in pro scouting, what's the key to this game? And one of them brought up a simple point that has a lot of layers to it. So the key to the game is the number of possessions. And what he meant by that was, if the possessions are low, that means Mahomes has been off the field a bunch. The Niners are controlling the ball, probably controlling the clock, and likely controlling the game. If there are lots of possessions, that means probably that the Chiefs are getting the Niners off the field and scoring fast. And so I 100% agree with what you're saying there, Tom. Finding a way to have 8, 10, 12 play drives, running the ball effectively and controlling the clock, all that stuff is very, very key for the Niners. Question number six. This is the last one of the week from Terry Mason. That's at Donuts 1888. Will the Colts go after a quarterback in free agency? I think they will, but I don't think they'll overextend for it. So I think they've got a couple of guys in their list, and I think there are a couple of guys that have interest in going there. Frank Reich and the offensive coordinator, Nick Sirianni, have strong connections to Philip Rivers from San Diego. I do think that Rivers is somebody that they would kick the tires on, would be of interest to them as sort of a bridge, 2-year solution for the franchise as it tries to find its long-term answer. The other name is Nick Foles. So if he comes available, I think Frank Reich would show some interest in him. So those would be the two names that I would watch. I don't think they're going to just, go out there and say, we're absolutely positively going to pay some quarterback. I think there's certainly a chance, if it's not Foles or Rivers, that maybe they just, add a body in the draft or something like that. So I do think they're going to look at every avenue to improve in their quarterback room that right now has Jacoby Brissett and Brian Hoyer in it. My guess is that they will take swings at a couple of big-name veteran quarterbacks, and if that doesn't work, turn around and go to the draft. All right, well, we're just about at the end of the season. The Niners and the Chiefs kick off in 5 days, but I know you guys are going to stick around after that. You know what that means. I need your feedback as we get into the offseason, because we're going to have you covered wall to wall. Lots of quarterback intrigue coming over the next few months, both in the draft and on the veteran market. We'll have combine. We'll have free agency. We'll have the trade market. We'll have the draft. We're going to have you covered, and we want to keep making the podcast better. So the way you can do that, you can get to me, and you can give me your feedback. And you know where to get me: on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And of course, you can always listen to us right here on the MMQB NFL podcast. I'm not the only one. If you bang that button and you download and subscribe on that feed, you're also going to get Johnny and Connor's podcast, the Weekside podcast that pops on Wednesdays, the Monday morning podcast recapping all the Sunday action, and of course, the Thursday podcast. And if you guys just want your news, if you get out of work, maybe you weren't paying attention, maybe you want to catch up on everything happening that happened during the day in the NFL, you can get that on the MMQB news feed. That is every weekday, goes up in the afternoon. And again, if you're getting out of work, you want to catch up on what's happening, you get in the car, you pop that in, we get you in and out in about 5 minutes. You can get both podcasts, the MMQB NFL podcast and the MMQB News podcast, on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. And always remember to go to iTunes, too. Leave us a review. Leave us a rating. That helps people find us. Same time next week, we'll have a Super Bowl champion, and I'll talk to you guys then.